Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
News, as you know, doesn't always come at convenient times for you or for us and our ratings. So we'll be tape delaying the broadcast today. But if you want to know what's on the show right now, go ahead and try Twitter. Hashtag Marketplace Fail.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the last one of July 2012. Good to have you with us. Okay, so I was kidding about tape delaying the show. You knew that, right? But a lot of people, like my whole Twitter feed and well beyond, have been stewing over what NBC is doing to the Olympics. Strategic tape delays to get the good stuff on the air in prime time. It's crazy-making because it's almost impossible not to know who won or who lost before good old-fashioned broadcast television tells us. And the kicker to this whole thing is that NBC's audience numbers for the games are better than ever. Jeff Jarvis writes and talks about this stuff all the time. His most recent book on the topic is called Public Parts. Jeff, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Why are people so upset about this? I mean, it started on Friday night with the opening ceremonies and has not relented.
The head of NBC Sports just said to a reporter that people don't have an inalienable right to get everything they want. Well, maybe on the internet, we do think we can get everything we want, and we expect to have the very best there. And we're in a world now where we know information immediately, and for someone to still try to control that and keep it from us doesn't work anymore.
It's a trust thing, right? We are trusting NBC to do us right.
What a channel does is curate, in the word we like to use online. It picks the best stuff. It adds value to that. And so the audience is still asking NBC to do its job on its old-fashioned channels.
So it seems to me that NBC is stuck a little bit, right, between the disgruntled masses who want what they want when they want it and the billions of dollars that it has invested in this whole thing, the Olympics.
NBC is really stuck between old business models and a new internet reality. The good news for them ought to be that the audience is mad that they're not putting some of the important live events on the old-fashioned broadcast channel. Twitter is a gigantic spoiler machine, and Facebook and the blogs. So I believe if they showed these hot contests during the day, there'd be even more chatter on Twitter, and there'd be even a bigger audience. Instead, what there is a huge new hashtag called NBC Fail, which is at least as entertaining as ping pong.
Yeah, that's right. All that the ping pong was pretty good. The other thing that needs to be talked about, though, Jeff, is the economic relationship between Twitter and NBC, right?
Yes. Twitter and NBC now have a relationship, which means Twitter has a business model, but it also led to some problems. Twitter suspended the account of Guy Adams, who's a journalist for The Independent in London, who complained about the Olympics coverage and also put out the email address of an NBC executive. Well, this worried a lot of us. You and I in media worry about the wall between church and state. Trust is our business. Trust is our asset. And if we found ourselves giving favor to our advertisers, we'd lose that trust.
How much do you think Twitter's using this NBC relationship as a test bed, really, to see what they can get going?
Twitter has been a huge success and platform in search of a business model. So if it can find ways to work with media properties, it's working with NASCAR and now with the Olympics, I think that's the beginning of a sustainable future for Twitter. But the fear is that it could change the very essence of Twitter. If Twitter starts to favor its advertisers over its users, if it becomes less of a platform and more of a closed media entity, that would be a great disappointment.
Yeah, well, it's a question of what it becomes, right? Does it stay a tech company or does it become a media company?
We're changing the definition of both. And necessarily, a tech company will become a media company, and a media company darn well better become a tech company or they won't survive. Hmm.
Jeff Jarvis, his book about all this stuff is called Public Parts. You can get him on Twitter at Jeff Jarvis. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Continuing with the theme of changes that digital technology has wrought, there is this. The next time you stop by a 7-Eleven for a Slurpee, you might also be able to pick up that package you ordered from Amazon. Amazon is outfitting 7-Elevens in a couple of different test markets with what it's calling Amazon Lockers, so packages don't have to be sent to your home or to your office. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains that.
Here's how the Amazon lockers work. When you order, you click on the shipping address of the locker near you. When your package arrives, Amazon sends you an email with a code. You go to your local 7-Eleven. We went to one in Arlington, Virginia, just outside of Washington. The Amazon locker was kitty-corner from the cat food. It's about 10 feet long and as tall as your refrigerator. You punch in your code and voila, there's that shiny new Kindle you ordered. Sucharita Mulparu is an online retail analyst at Forrester Research.
I think that they're aiming at late adopters to the internet, you know, or people who, for whatever reason, have hesitated purchasing products from Amazon.
Maybe they're afraid their pricey packages will be stolen from their doorsteps or rained on. Or maybe, says Catherine Hutt of the Council of Better Business Bureaus, it's none of our business.
People don't want the people that they live or work with to see what they're ordering. I'm not sure, but.
Larry Weber is head of W2 Group, a digital marketing firm. He says Amazon might be thinking way outside the box, imagining a time when we order something in the morning and pull it out of an Amazon locker in the afternoon.
Almost like your salad for lunch.
Weber says Amazon could piggyback on 7-Eleven's just-in-time delivery system. Amazon itself is being cagey about its plans. My repeated emails and phone calls to the company were not returned by deadline. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There was a little of this, a little of that on Wall Street today. By the bell, though, not a whole lot of change in the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been hot out there this summer, 102 degrees today in Little Rock, Arkansas, for just one example. So hot has it been and so dry that a lot of people, our listeners among them, are actually changing the way they do business. Here you go. Take a listen.
My home office is costing more. Third floor plus heat rising equals unexpected costs.
I work at a power plant, and when it gets really hot, we turn off office overhead lights and work by desk lamps.
My small retail business is in a downtown area. The heat has killed business. Who would want to be around concrete when you can be at the lake?
The thoughts of Susan Strayer, Charles Briggs, and Jenna Hansen, recorded by some of our Marketplace team here in L.A. Our stories are posted on Facebook and Twitter, where you can tell us if the way you do business has changed because of the drought and the heat. You can tweet us at MarketplaceAPM. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
From our wealth and poverty desk now, a story about a strike that's been going on down in Houston, Texas for the past couple of weeks. Janitors, hundreds of them, office cleaning crews mostly, are asking for a raise from $8.35 to $10 an hour over the next 3 years. Janitors in Houston, it turns out, are some of the lowest paid in the country, but the offices that they clean belong to some of the richest companies in the world. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark went down to Houston to talk to some of the people who work in the same offices but have very different lives.
Skyscrapers in Houston, like most skyscrapers, are places where janitors and the people whose offices they clean are kind of like ships passing in the night.
Just hello in the elevator.
Hello, how you doing? Fine, thanks, bye.
They keep different hours, often speak different languages, so the distance between janitors and office workers makes sense. But it's weird, too. Every day they walk or vacuum the same carpet. They breathe or deodorize the same air. They even look at or dust the same pictures.
This is my grandbaby, her mom and dad.
¿Ellos hacen lo mismo que yo?
That last voice is Lorenza Delgado, a janitor at Wells Fargo Plaza in downtown Houston. She says when she sees those photos of smiling families on the desks she cleans, she smiles. Thinks to herself, the people who work at those desks, they're just like me.
They love their families, and they're working to provide a better future for them. That's why they keep them close.
Delgado's sitting in her hot, tiny living room in one of the poorest neighborhoods in Houston, and every surface is covered with pictures of her daughter, 6-year-old Leonarda. Two above the couch.
Leonarda, Leonarda.
A bunch more perched on a little table.
Leonarda, Leonarda.
Leonarda at her preschool graduation. Leonarda standing next to a model rocket ship.
Muchas Leonardas.
Delgado runs through those images every night on her commute to work. 2.5 hours round trip by bus. But her family, her childcare issues, that stuff didn't come up in the quick interactions she'd have with office workers while she was cleaning. Until a few years ago, when she met a woman on the 53rd floor.
Erika.
Erica Vasquez. I'm an administrative assistant. The first time I met Lorenza, I was working a late night and she came around to, you know, take out the trash. So I just started talking to her.
Vasquez speaks Spanish, but their conversations had to be brief. With so many offices to clean, Delgado literally runs through the halls to get it all done. Still, in passing exchanges, little things have come out that give Vasquez a better picture of Delgado's life. Take the recyclables everyone thought the building was sorting. Turns out, Delgado was collecting them.
She would take the cans and get money for the cans to at least pay a bill or something. The amount she makes barely pays enough to pay the rent.
Not to mention food or school supplies or Delgado's diabetes meds. The $12,000 that Delgado makes a year is well below the poverty line for a family of two.
It's not fair. They work so hard, get paid so little. I don't know how she does it.
Vasquez tried to get Delgado a higher-paying job cleaning rooms at a hospital, but there wasn't a good bus route there. As for Vasquez's bigger question of what's fair when it comes to pay,
no justice.
That's exactly what striking janitors like Delgado are trying to get office workers in Houston to think about. They've been holding daily marches in front of towers owned by companies like Exxon, Shell, and J.P. Morgan Chase. They say if Houston's corporate skyline is booming, why are they paid so little?
There was a demonstration outside my window. It was quite loud.
Drew Wellner is a lawyer who works in a downtown skyscraper. He's gotten to know some of the janitors who work in his office.
They're very hardworking people. They're always very nice. But I don't know that cleaning the offices of people who make more money necessarily correlates into what they should be making.
But for most of the 20th century, that's how it worked, according to University of Massachusetts economist Aaron Dubay.
Used to be the case that regardless if the person was a CEO or the person who cleaned the CEO's office, when the company was doing better, everyone tended to do a little bit better. That has changed.
One of the main reasons that's changed, Dubay says, is this. Today, if you're a janitor, you probably don't work for the owners of the building you clean. Instead, you work for and collectively bargain with subcontractors, national and multinational cleaning companies, all vying to be the lowest bidders for their customers, the buildings.
You end up becoming hired by a middleman. That makes it easier for, let's say, a building owner to not have to pay higher wages when their profits are doing pretty well.
Which brings us to another conversation a janitor recently had with not exactly the person who works in the building she cleans, but the CEO of the company the building is named after.
Mr. Diamond, thank you for appearing today.
J.P. Morgan Chase is the third biggest owner of buildings where Houston janitors work. And last month, the man who runs J.P. Morgan Chase happened to be testifying before Congress.
I think you've made about $19 billion in 2011 thereabout. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
In a union publicity stunt after Jamie Dimon's testimony, a janitor named Adriana Vasquez walked up to him. She cleans J.P. Morgan Chase Tower in Houston, and she says she had a question.
Mr. Diamond, you make the billions of dollars every year. Why do you deny the people cleaning your buildings a living wage?
Diamond told her to call his office. She's still waiting to hear back. When I called Chase and the other major building owners in Houston to ask about janitors' wages, I got answers like this.
Hey, Chrissy, this is Greg Hassel at Chase calling you back. Don't have a comment for this one.
Chrissy, hi. Patrick McKinn calling with ExxonMobil. We're really not interested in being in your story at all. We don't like getting involved in things that we don't have anything to do with.
I mean, you know, at a certain level, does Jamie Dimon know what that person is making? Of course not.
Here's Aaron Dubé again, the economist. He says Chase, Exxon, the other companies that dominate the Houston skyline, it's not like they're directly dictating the terms of janitors' pay, but they hire the contractors who do. And there's another simpler way that Chase's and the Exxons of the world are connected to the janitors.
Every employee, including their CEO, presumably needs to use the bathroom. And when they go into the bathroom, it has to be clean. This is a very basic necessity that is filled. You know, they can't work in an office overrun with trash.
When I work in the floors, I always look in the pictures and I'm always imagining, wow, there are so many happy faces.
A janitor named Hernan Trujillo started cleaning offices soon after graduating from high school to help pay for his mom's medical bills when she got sick. And when he looks at the photos on the desks he cleans, there's one that always gets to him.
The one that it's always making me sad is, sorry. The kid is graduated from college. And, sorry. That was one of my parents' dreams.
That's why janitors in Houston are striking, Trujillo says. If they got paid even a little more, enough to make ends meet and save a bit at the end of the month, it's the sort of thing that could maybe help families like his send their kids to college, like in those pictures on the desks he cleans. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You want to look like it's a partnership and the harmony between you and your horse.
Sit up straight in that saddle. Everything you need to know about dressage. But first, let's do the numbers. Negative day, positive month. The Dow Industrials dipped 0.5% today, 64 points, 13,008. The NASDAQ reversed 0.2%, 6 points, 29.39. The S&P 500 off 0.4%, 5 points, 13.79 is the number you're looking for there. For July, the Dow picked up 1%. The NASDAQ stepped up 0.2%. The S&P 500 advanced 1.3%. Facebook's botched IPO continues to take its toll, if you can believe that. Shares in UBS fell more than 4% today after the Swiss bank reported it lost more than $350 million on that IPO. In the rest of the banking world, Morgan Stanley added more than 1%. Bank of America deposited 0.8%. Luxury stocks were tarnished by fears among the worried wealthy. Coach got creamed after reporting a drop in same-store sales. Shares down by more than 18%. Tiffany unloaded 4% today. Saks gave back 1.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for June. Automakers are slated to release U.S. sales for July. And VJs started spinning music videos back in 1981 with the launch of MTV. And if you remember that, you probably don't get carded much anymore. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. I don't know if you saw this news item yesterday, a blackout in India that had left 300 million people without power, or basically the entire population of the United States. It got, if you can believe this, worse today, three power failures and more than 680 million people without electricity. Power outages, though, aren't new to India. In fact, the whole backup generator industry has sprung up over there, catering to businesses and the rich. But for the country as a whole, growing as fast as it is, there is a fairly intractable problem that this presents, demand outstripping the power supply. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
India's farmers reportedly triggered the disaster,
With no rain, they use electric pumps to water their crops, overtaxing the local power grid. The failures are believed to have cascaded across northern India. Trains stopped, hospitals canceled surgeries, crematoriums switched from electricity to wood. I reached English professor Adil Mehdi in New Delhi, just as he lost power again. No word on when it'll return.
Yesterday, it took 13 hours. This afternoon, it had failed again for 3-4 hours. Now it's gone again.
I tried an old joke on him. When you lose the internet, you're back to 1979. When you lose power, you're back to 1879. He sighed.
Refrigerator doesn't work. AC is not working. Fans are not working. Not much we can do, actually, without electricity, because it's quite hot and muggy in Delhi. You tend to sweat a lot.
In a big country growing out of poverty, power demand for cell phones and appliances is exploding. They need more power plants. But economist Arvind Panagiriya at Columbia University says the weak link is the distribution system. It's corrupt. Companies that deliver electricity are losing money because of theft and meter tampering.
And the most important factor, of course, is that politicians love to give free electricity to the farmers.
The result is a paradox. Transmission companies can't afford to buy more power as much as people want it. So investors won't build more power plants. It's too soon to know technically what went wrong this time, but companies with power grid questions, we know who we are, will be paying attention. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We'll get the July unemployment report Friday morning. And whatever virtues it might have as an economic indicator, it does have this key failing. It's a number, a cold, hard number, nothing much personal at all about it. We've been talking to 29-year-old Sandra Morin on and off for almost a year now about being unemployed and then getting a job at the Chicago Office of Tourism and Culture. And as we learned last week, being unemployed one more time. Sandra, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you as well.
So what happened? I mean, I'm sorry this isn't under happier circumstances.
The office closed on June 30th. We were notified in mid-January that that was going to happen, so we did have a good heads up.
Yeah.
But it's an office of 88 people who lost their jobs.
When they told you in January that this was coming this summer, how did you spend those 6 months? I mean, what was it like sort of knowing that this was all going to come to a crashing halt?
It was a shock, especially because I had just gone through all of that. So that was very, very recent turnaround, very fast turnaround. And I developed really, really good relationships with almost everyone in the office. So I ended up creating a wonderful network of people who will act as my references and vice versa.
I don't want to minimize what I'm sure is a lousy experience, but you sound fairly upbeat.
Well, that might be personality.
Okay.
It also might be just kind of looking forward to opportunities on the horizon. It's summer. My birthday is this week, so those are good things.
Yeah.
But I mean, I need to find a job in the next 6 to 8 months. That's an absolute necessity. You can carry on, you know, with your life and pay your bills on unemployment for a while.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily contributing to a culture, to a society, to the economy.
Yeah. You know those polls you see every now and then? You see them a lot in the presidential race, but you see them from time to time elsewhere about whether the country's on the right track or the wrong track economically?
Mm-hmm.
How do you answer sitting there right now in Chicago without a job?
I think it's on the wrong track. I think that what I see happening is temporary solutions, Band-Aid solutions, but not long-term sustainable job creation solutions.
Mm-hmm. What happens, Sandra, if by Christmas you don't have a job?
I will have a job.
Huh. Sandra Morin, she's in Chicago looking for a job. Sandra, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
I blinked, so I might have missed it, but I think NBC squeezed about 25 seconds worth of dressage into its broadcast last night. The first round of equestrian events went off today. No spoilers here. Not for us. Not going to tell you who won. But you have surely heard the name of the most famous dressage athlete in this year's games, Rafalka, the horse co-owned by Ann Romney, of course. Thanks to her, the horse, not Mrs. Romney, dressage has had more publicity than perhaps ever before. So we asked Dan Gorenstein from New Hampshire Public Radio what it takes to get involved with and excel in that rarefied, blue-blooded world.
First, there's the horse.
A horse is a horse, of course.
No. This isn't about running the fastest or jumping the highest. Dressage horses are artists.
We do movements that are very, very difficult. These horses, it's like dancers.
Pamela Goodrich has a barn full of dressage horses.
Come here, honey. I got feeding time.
Goodrich explains to me how precise and technical the moves are. Horses must canter in perfect tight circles, shift gaits every stride so it looks like they're skipping. The art is to coax a 1,200-pound beast to go against its instincts and love it. Not easy for a novice like me.
My recommendation for you would be to get a professor to teach you.
Goodrich introduces me to a horse named Lamborghini.
And he is a Lamborghini. Very spicy to ride.
Pretty hot price tag, too, if he were for sale.
$60,000 to $100,000?
The professor can't do all the teaching. I need a trainer.
You should probably be on your horse 6 days a week, the seventh day at least doing something with it.
Someone like Catherine Dow. Even at the low end, Dow says that's going to cost $1,500 a month. And she says, I need to hit the gym hard.
Because you're going to have to work on your core strength.
Dow tells me top riders get their horses to make all these intricate moves subtly. To win, it must look effortless.
You want to look like it's a partnership and the harmony between you and your horse.
Speaking of looks, elegance is essential.
Welcome to Dover Saddlery.
Janet Nittman of the tack store Dover Saddlery shows me to the changing room where my finery awaits.
Either one of these ones.
In dressage, the clothes capture both the fussiness and the grandeur, some would say opulence, of the sport. White breeches, top hat, silk tie, white gloves, and an antiquated cut of a coat, the shad belly.
Short waist at the front and then the long tails at the back. So sophisticated. A judge can't help being influenced by a beautifully turned out rider.
I slip on the coat. Wow. But influence is expensive. Shad belly.
$879.
Top hat.
$400.
Breeches.
$379.
Gloves.
$62.
Silk tie.
$100.
And custom boots start at
$1,000.
That doesn't include anything for my horse, like a saddle. Nittman says there is a range, but if I work my way to the top, it's going to cost me.
We're talking over $12,000.
Now, there's just one last thing to do. Go see a loan officer. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, catching up to where we started, that way modern life has of sucking all the fun and joy out of a once every 4 years global celebration of sport. The sports blog Deadspin took its turn today, cross-referencing current prices on precious metal exchanges with Olympic hardware. Gold medals, it turns out, are mostly silver to begin with a gilded layer on top. Street value, about $644. Silver medals are about $330. Bronze medals are mostly zinc and tin, worth $5 on the street. Or, if you look at it the right way, the way we ought to, actually, priceless, right? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Tuesday. The Dow dipped 0.5% today, 64 points. The NASDAQ off 0.2%, 6 points. The S&P 500 down 0.4%, 5 points on that particular index. Thanks to Mary Dew, John Haas, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.